listener production.
Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday Mailbag edition. With me, Scott Phillips, who works for the Motley Fool as our Chief Investment Officer. We give independent stock recommendations and investment advice and education. And him, Andrew Page, the Managing Director and Founder of Strawman.com, which is, what again?
It's our private investment club.
I think it's a private online investment club, Andrew.
Sorry, online.
You clearly haven't been listening club. Well
Thank
enough.
You.
I have
Thank
been
you.
Paying attention.
Good catch.
Mate, it is good to chat to you again. Feels like 2 days, but it's really only been 15 minutes because we just did the last episode. We are going to record our Sunday mailbag episode, which is your favourite? Would you prefer the Friday eps or the Sunday eps? Do you have a favourite?
I think I lean towards the mailbag because at least we know we're talking about stuff that people are interested in rather than what we want to talk about. But I like both of them.
I think what you just said is what I thought, which is actually Friday's more fun because we get to talk about what we want to talk about, but Sunday feels more fulfilling because we're actually doing something that other people.
That's the way I was
saying it. We're actually helping in the other case, which is always nice. Mate, yes, this is one of our last episodes before I go on leave. We've got some next week to do as well. And then I'm off into the wild blue yonder. I have said already on Friday's app, if you want any questions answered, do. I don't think I'll share the socials again today because it's boring for everybody, but you know what they are. Look us up on any of the socials or info@fool.com.au and you can find us there. Mate, a great question from Joseph to pick up the episode. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this because I love this one. Not so much in terms of, well, partly in investing, partly the macro and kind of the policy stuff, which you know we both love. Joseph says, Scott, picking up on Ram and your discussion of Norway's pension fund, what about diving into it? I hear it's the single largest owner of public companies in the world. Maybe their investment style or objectives or whatever have some interesting parallels for regular folks. Do they just buy everything or are they some super smart folks over there doing something we can learn from? Always love the podcast. Cheers, mate. Full on from Joseph. Now, mate, I did, unusually for us, I did a little, well, I wouldn't say research, I clicked on the link that Joseph sent me. mate, you know I love sovereign wealth funds, you know I love the idea, and this is just super smart, right? I'm reading through this thing going, my God, how are the Norwegians so smart and we're so unbelievably stupid? So let me just read a bit, a quick summary of, for those who don't know what this is. This is from there, it's the, I think it's, is it Norges? Norges? So anyway, it's the Norwegian way of saying Norway. So we I don't know why we use other countries' names. We call other countries our own names rather than their names, which is always bizarre. But anyway, this is from the investment management firm that manages the fund, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. They just say this. Norway's oil fund, or the Government Pension Fund Global, which is its official name, was created after we discovered oil in the North Sea. The fund was set up to shield the economy from ups and downs in oil revenue. It also serves as a financial reserve and as a long-term savings plan so that both current and future generations get to benefit from our oil wealth. They say it was decided early on that revenue from oil and gas should be used cautiously in order to avoid imbalances in the economy. In 1990, the Norwegian Parliament passed legislation to support this, creating what is now the Government Pension Fund Global. As the name suggests, it was decided the fund should only be invested abroad, which is also interesting. Oil revenue has been very important for Norway, they say, but one day the oil will run out. The aim of the fund is to ensure that we use this money responsibly, think long term, and so safeguard the future of the Norwegian economy. And mate, I kind of swoon a little bit and then curse the nutbaggery in Canada. Canada, in Canberra. How am I going with Canada? Nutbaggery in Canberra. Sorry to Canadian listeners.
Straight out
of the bus tonight. Yeah, that's right. Your bloody fault, you bastards.
They are a very similar economy, should be pointed out.
And just like, you know, so the fund is now one of the world's largest funds, owning almost 1.5% of all the shares in the world's listed companies. It means we have holdings in 9,000 companies worldwide, entitling us to a small share of their profits each year. In addition, the fund owns hundreds of buildings in some of the world's leading cities, which generate rental income. The fund also receives a steady flow of income from lending to countries and companies. By spreading our investments widely, we reduce the risk of the fund losing money. Each year, the Norwegian government can only spend a small part of the fund, but this still amounts to almost 20% of the government budget. There is a broad political consensus on how the fund should be managed. The less we spend today, the better the position we will be in to deal with downturns and crises in future. Budget surpluses are transferred to the fund while deficits are covered with money from the fund. In other words, the authorities can spend more in hard times and less in good times so that the fund benefits as many people as possible in the future too. Police have agreed on a fiscal rule which ensures we do not spend more than the expected return on the fund. Bloody hell, mate. Like, doesn't it drive you just slightly spare that we have done absolutely nothing like this?
Oh, where do you start? And the thing is, let me just say right at the beginning, like, it feels like, oh, I've got to, it's like talking about religion or politics or sex. You know, it's sort of, it's that, it's an uncomfortable thing to talk about because people have such firm views on this stuff. And I think certain ideologies have just, from either side, kind of make things sound controversial when they really shouldn't be controversial. Right. Like, some things that are just black and white, like whether, you know, here it is. At the end of the day, natural resources are a finite resource. They belong to the people of the country. We should use them as judiciously and responsibly as we can, but they'll go at some point, right? And we could live like there's no tomorrow and have a great party with that money. Or what we've done, we could let other people come in and have a great time with that money and then let them leave and we'll pick up all the mess and maybe get a few scraps. Or we could take that money and we could invest it forever and just have this brilliant portfolio of that we're just, you know, what a, here's the thing with Norway, right? Population something like 5 million people and they own 1.4%. Like,
that's right.
What's the quality of life like in Norway?
Must be terrible, poor bastards. Yeah.
When it's interesting, there's been lots of books written on it. The Scandinavian model is, as it's called, is just, it's this fascinating. To me, I love it because it's sort of, it gets away from the ideology. It's kind of a blend of capitalism, of socialism. It sort of takes, it just sort of cherry picks the best things from everything and puts it together. There's no private schools in Norway and they have the highest levels of academic achievement. There's very, very low levels of homelessness and social problems in Norway. Like, just, they just get so much so right. It's one of the highest taxing places in the world, meaning, well, that sucks, but they also have the highest level of services and standards of living in the world too. It's just, they just get it right in so many different ways, and this is one way. So again, it sounds, I hear myself talking and I feel opinions being formed and judgments being made.
No, mate, you did right.
But I think, you know, I like to consider myself, whether it's true or not, it's probably not because we all fool ourselves, but I like to feel that I'm open-minded and I'm evidence-driven. And I think if that's who you are, then it's hard not to look at that and at the very least say, there's probably a few ideas we can copy there.
That page, just the homepage of the thing, just copy-paste that, you know, some legislation, get it done and start it tomorrow. Just, it's madness, absolutely freaking madness. Mate, so the question for Joseph wasn't so much about the fund itself, although we just covered that, and that to me, despite Joseph's question, is the strongest reason to talk about it, just given how incredibly successful it's been, how just stupidly smart and obvious the idea is. He asked about the companies they invest in, mate. I will say, for what it's worth, because they are so big, it's hard to take too much from it. If I was to summarize their investing. So they do say, by the way, they do make some choices around. So firstly, it's global only, which I actually love. I think this is, and Australia would do well to copy that, right? We've got enough money invested locally and the economy is local.
We're less than 2% of global markets, right?
So, yeah. Invest the thing globally.
Diversify.
Yeah. So that's number one. Second thing is they have, I'm not necessarily a fan of this strategy necessarily, but they actually do invest across a whole lot of classes. They talked about that. 72% of the fund is in equities, shares. 25% in fixed income, 2.5% in property, and then apparently 0.1% in renewable energy infrastructure, which is really funny in and of itself. But go on.
I'm going to blow your mind a little bit.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, no, it's Finland. I was going to say there's some crypto in there too, I think.
I'm sure there's not. I'll just put that there and let's move on. Stupid, mate. Let's not get carried away. But yeah, so 3/4 in equities, 1/4 in fixed income, and 2.5% in investments, roughly. In real estate, sorry. So I thought that was interesting in and of itself. I would put it all in equities personally, although if they've got a cash requirement for the for the government to either receive or give a surplus and deficits, then it makes a whole lot of sense. They have some fixed income just to smooth the flow, like we do with Everlasting Income at the Motley Fool, our service we have for income. It makes some sense to have some cash available. I think that's way too high personally, but you know, who am I to tell the Norwegian pension fund what they should do? So I thought that was interesting just in and of itself, mate. Market value, $1.4 trillion, if you don't mind, which I just thought was also really, really impressive. So there's that. And then just to the question, by the way, if you want to check out the website, nbim.no for Norway, it's really cool. They actually list all the stocks. So the number one position is Apple, worth $24 billion. Then Microsoft at almost the same amount, and Alphabet, Google, Amazon, Nestle, Meta Platforms that owns Facebook, Taiwan Semiconductor, Tesla, Roche, the drug company, ASML, computer chip company, Nvidia, another computer chip company, and so on. Royal Dutch Shell, Samsung, Tencent, Berkshire Hathaway, Vonovia, LVMH, the company that owns Moët Hennessy, Louis Vuitton, Novo Nordisk, and so on. I own some of those companies. I'm not going to disclose each one because I went through a whole list then. You get the idea, and you know which ones I already own. So I just thought it was a really interesting summary of, you know, they look like they are picking stocks. It doesn't look like, in fact, if you look at the weightings, they own 11% of a company called Vonovia in Germany. They own 3.5% of Royal Dutch Shell, but only 0.8% of Apple. So I have to assume there's some active stock picking there somewhere, at least proportionally in terms of the average weighting. But it also seems to me they own almost all the big ones, just in slightly different variations, as you have to. If you own 1% of the companies in the world, you have to some degree, you know, be a little bit indexy, a little bit index hugging. So maybe it's just the equivalent of one very, very large ETF. I'm not sure. Your thoughts on any of the holdings, mate, or the stories there?
So this is you know, it's such a great idea as an idea. As with so many things, it comes down to the execution. So, you know, I guess if you wanted to be critical of it, you could say, what a great idea. And then you look at their portfolio and it is all in crypto or something like that. You could think, well, you know, so it does depend. And there is going to be some stock picking skill that's there. When you have, what did you say, 1.4 trillion there? It's kind
looks
of
like it based on the number. You just US own, dollars too, by the way, not Australian. So that's what, close to 2 trillion, right? Australian, I suppose.
By the way, do some maths on that. Mm-hmm. Say that they sort of average 10% long term. Argue whatever that should be. Mm-hmm. That's like $30,000 US for every single man, woman, and child in that country each year for doing nothing.
Yep.
Forever, right? Like, it's kind of, it's hard to wrap your head around that. So they will get to a point, you know, presumably, where it's just like, you know what? None of us need to work anymore. Let's just live off the dividend.
20% of the government budget is funded by this thing. Like, yeah. if that is not public policy beauty, I don't know what is.
And look, it didn't happen overnight. But look, so I'm already off tangent. Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. I would do it. I would, like you, I would go very heavily into equity because this is long term. It's actually a forever investment time frame. So you can handle the volatility. I would go for all the biggest and best companies around the world, Europe, America, Asia, Africa, you name it, just whatever. Yeah. If it's a good quality company, and I would do it. It's just like a global ETF, really. Be a bunch of rubbish in there, and there'll be some absolutely outstanding things in there. And it's
more or less.
I call it 5%. I mean, people will, oh, you'll never get that. Whatever it is, you know, it's the great thing about a big portfolio and a very simple direct investment strategy is that very little work to administer. This is the benefit of being rich, right? Like, think about it on a human level, not on a nation state level.
Exactly.
And I gave you $5 billion and like you can't, it's Brewster's Millions. You can't spend it, right? It's just, you know, and not only that, you can actually do a lot of good with it within how you direct the fund. It's just, it's the smartest thing in the world. And I just wish more countries would do it. So so here's the thing, right? So they made their money out of fossil fuels.
Yeah, exactly.
Now that era is ending. You can debate what the timeline is there, but they're not idiots. They saw the writing on the wall ages ago. And by the way, we should have a conversation about how their energy minister administered all. They taxed the foreign nationals. I think it was 78% for the tax rate. And so they said, yeah, come on in. We've got heaps of oil and gas. Go for it. Okay. But we're going to charge you, you know, no, we can't do it. It's like, all right, don't come. Oh, okay, we'll do it. Well, we better make some money than none, right? And like, look what we did here. We sold our own assets to other people. It's just madness. I don't know, mate. I'm just so in awe of it. I'm so in awe of it. It is something that anyone with a bit of vision and leadership should. And it's the thing is too. It's you would imagine it's such an easy sell. Like, what's controversial? Oh, like, if you're a politician, if Anthony Albanese got up and said, "Hey, we're going to start doing this," it just anyway. We've fawned over it enough, I guess. But it was a great question. It's a great idea. We should see more of it.
Yep. It's just an absolute no-brainer. I can't even, mate. It's so obviously a great idea for a million different reasons, and we're blowing the mineral wealth. It is not going to go forever. Even iron ore. Once you dig it up, you know, how many hundred million years do we have to wait for the next lot to form? Like, this is not an infinite resource. Like, literally, one very quick rant. To believe either implicitly or explicitly that we can take an asset left to us by our forebears, take it out of the ground, mine it, sell it, and then use that money on whatever bloody consumption I feel like doing today and leaving nothing behind for the kids that they can't use because we've taken it. Sorry, kids, spent the inheritance, bad luck. Mm. In a country that we inherited it, it's a one-off resource, literally a finite resource in any human time scale. To literally just say, yep, we spent it, bad luck.
It's worse than that. It's not. We didn't even. I mean, if you want to break it down, there's been some good think tank studies on this kind of stuff. I mean, it's gas is the one that's in the news at the moment, so the figures are more at the top of my mind. But I think it's the vast majority of it is foreign owned, and they pay very little profit, very small amount in royalties. So it's not as if the money that was there to be made, most of it didn't come back to the pockets of Australians. So it's what you're saying, but worse. It's not like we spent the grandkids' inheritance. We gave the grandkids' inheritance to someone from overseas who went over to Europe and America and spent it. Like it's that bad. And people will think that sounds controversial, but it's fact. Sickening. Absolutely sickening.
Bizarre, mate. Bizarre. Okay, let's move on because I can't do any more of this. Dear Scott and Andrew, says Mick. Love the podcast. Great banter. No BS. Have you been listening? No spin information. You keep us learning. Thank you, mate. Mr. Page, says Mick. Jeez. Doesn't know you very well. Requested a challenge. My question is, how would you design an income-producing portfolio using only index ETFs? And here's his conditions. $1 million is the starting capital. No more can be added from employment income. The aim is to produce an average 5% plus return whilst preserving the capital against inflation. How would you gentlemen achieve this? And would you leave some in cash to ride out the downturns? I realise this is general advice only. Thanking you in advance. Best regards, Mick. There you go, mate. Mick has laid down the $1 million, 5% return, ETFs only. What you got, Hotshot? That's the movie scene.
Well, I mean, if I'm building my own ETF, that's a different thing.
Not building your own ETF. He wants to use index ETFs.
So if it's an index ETF, well, I'm just going to get the yield of whatever the market is. I think the yield of the Aussie market at the moment is something like 3.5%, I want to say. So probably close to 5% if you want to throw in franking credits. So there you go. Buy the ASX 200 and you'd be close. There are specific income ETFs out there. So that feels like I could do that, which will have higher yields. Feels a bit like it's cheating, but in answering the question, it probably achieves that. The trouble I have with a lot of these income ETFs is that they, as we've talked about repeatedly, they go out and they buy all the stuff with the highest yield. And people are going, Andrew, what's your problem with that? That sounds like exactly what you should do. But as we've often talked about, the best income producers are often ones that start with a lower yield, but then the dividends grow at a much faster rate. So I would much prefer a yield of 3% where the dividends grow 10% each year than something that's a 5% yield where it grows at like 0.5% each year. I'm just significantly better off after any meaningful period of time. It's a hard question. Would I leave any cash on the sideline? Well, it depends, right? So let's say this is why financial planners always say, you know, you've got to take your own personal circumstances into account. Let's say for the sake of argument, you own your own house. There's no mortgage on it. You own it. and you got $1 million. So on a 5% grossed up yield, you know, you're getting 50 grand. That's $1,000 a week, more or less. Mm. You don't have any rent or mortgage to pay. Pretty good lifestyle right there.
It's good
more
result.
Than enough for overseas trip and, you know, lots of avocado and toast. Yeah, it covers.
No lettuce, to be fair, these days.
No, avocado. Come on. No, maybe some cabbage.
Even the cabbage is going up in price, mate. Substitution effect.
Saw a great chart during the week, which was cabbage the price features. Of avocados.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they've been one of the best inflation hedges. So if you go back in, they're like, where do I put my money? I need to hedge against inflation. Avocados, turns out.
I'm not sure, mate, that would have stood the test of time. I don't think an avocado bought 7 years ago would be worth as much as it might have otherwise been, but I take your point more broadly.
No.
As an asset class or something.
As an asset class, yeah. It's a great question though, Mick. You've fenced me in a little bit there. There's a few constraints. Yeah. What would you say, Scott, then?
So I think I'll echo your point actually. Here's the thing. If you think about a portfolio that needs, well, the only thing I would say is right now, Mick wants to preserve the capital against inflation. That's going to be 7% this year. You will not actually do that this year. I don't think you can sustainably, with index ETFs or anything really, get 5% income plus inflation-beating returns and expect to do that this year. It's not going to happen. So there is a massive asterisk for me, which is just it assumes that inflation isn't out of control and doesn't stay high forever because, you know, you're just not going to. But if we were to say inflation is likely to be, say, 3% over the long term, then 3% capital growth, 5% income is almost a doddle. It's better than you'll get almost any other time and across any foreseeable future. I think that's a very, very, very good very good index return. So realistically, Mick, you're kind of getting index return with that sort of thing anyway. Plus, as Andrew says, the franking credits on that. So here's what I would say, though. The challenge is actually not the income. The challenge is the capital. Because you can buy a portfolio chock full of banks and get 5% tomorrow, right? You could buy a bank ETF, I'm sure they're around, and do it and do completely fine, right? Do I think the capital will appreciate at 3% a year? I don't know. Probably, actually. Yeah, a reasonable guess, probably. But there'll be some times when, depending on when you put the money to work, if it was put to work today and the banks were expensive and then there's a crash and whatever, you may not preserve the capital every year against inflation or even total against inflation. You may find that in 10 years' time, you've taken your 5% out. Maybe you've got less than you started with or the same or something. Maybe you kept up with inflation. Maybe you haven't. So I think that's, you know, it's a really difficult one. I will say this is a cheat and it's also a half plug, but it's not intended to be. We have a service called Everlasting Income. I think I've talked about this before. Our current benchmark is 4% plus franking credits. And it's specifically that because we could get more, but we don't want to be overexposed to individual sectors or industries. So we have, I think it's, I want to say it's about 6-ish%, I think, of the entire portfolio in banks, and only one of those is one of the large banks. Because we don't want to have, you know, we could actually boost the income tomorrow by having more banks. We just don't want to. We don't think it's a good idea. We don't think it's smart. We don't think there's obvious value there. So we don't. But if you buy an index that's, you know, buy an ASX 200 or 300, you're getting half, you know, a third banks and financial companies. So that's kind of the reality. Those things are real. They are to some degree obvious. But I think for mine, there's also a high yield ETF around, which VHY, I think it's a Vanguard high yield, which is also interesting. Actually, what I'm going to say, Rem, I don't think you're going to get 5% plus excluding franking credits. Including franking credits, you could buy an ASX 200 index and just do it that way. And that's all you need to really do. You might do slightly better otherwise. You can't use international ETFs. They won't give you that sort of income in terms of cash income. This assumes, by the way, Mick, too, you want to get dividends rather than sell some to get the income out. Because that's the other thing, right? You could, you know, if you, it's like Berkshire, right? If you buy Berkshire and then just sell 5% of the holdings every year for your income if you wanted to do that. So it assumes you want to use it with pure dividend flows rather than generating income. So that's enough for that. Cash to ride out the downturns, kind of. So again, I'll talk about Everlasting Income, not as a plug, because we've actually thought this through. We have 4% of the Everlasting Income portfolio in cash, roughly, at any one point in time. It's partly about the downturns. It's partly about managing the cash flow between dividend seasons, honestly, because every 6 months you get dividends and you get nothing for a few months. Maybe you get a couple that trickle in. Sol Pats pays out of cycle. A couple others do too. I own some shares in that. Most pay in the same 2 or 3 months every year or every 6 months. So, you know, half the year you're getting something, the other half you're getting nothing. So we do it for that reason. But also, if we pay 4% out, so no surprise there. If every dividend in the portfolio went to zero for a full year, we could still pay those dividends. Now, they haven't, they won't. But if they were to halve for a short period of time, they go back up. We figure that's enough to ride out the downturns. Because again, we're talking about downturns in income. The share price can go all over the place. Shares could halve. And if the company is just as profitable, the dividends won't change. So there's no need to worry about that. You only need to worry if the profits fall and the dividends get cancelled or cut as a result. Is that a reasonable response, Ryan?
Yeah. Yep. I mean, it's one of those questions. I love it because it's pretty straightforward on the surface.
Yeah, but, you know, that's right.
You can
until you start scratching. Yep, yep.
There's nuance there, but
there really isn't.
Yeah,
nice.
I think we covered it.
Good question, Mick. Though I like it a lot, mate. So bottom line, I think five is probably more aggressive than you need to be, and might tempt you to take concentration risks I wouldn't take. One for the mailbag, says Matt. Hi, Scott and Andrew. I've been told that companies and the economy grow at a compounding rate, i.e. 8% per annum. Why is that the case? It seems to be true over the long term, but this sentiment, rings hollow to me without an explanation. We live in a finite world, so how are our economic systems set up to grow exponentially? It doesn't make any sense to me. Keep up the good work, Matthew. Matthew's also got an episode idea, which I'll get to in a minute. It's a really good question, Ram. Do you want to have a swing at that one?
It is an outstanding question. We too often accept things as fact without asking why.
Yep.
And when we do ask why, we tend to just refer to history and forget that actually a lot of these numbers come from extremely recent history. And you want to go back to the Stone Age, well, it hasn't compounded at that rate. I mean, mathematically, it can't compound at that rate.
Yep.
Right, because we just don't have the resource. So it's an excellent question. I've pondered the exact same thing myself. It's a very smart economist kind of make the argument that eventually we can't at some point. And then you get deep and metaphysical, right? It's just like, do we go into a more digital realm where actually those constraints aren't there?
Yep, yep.
You know, where the things that we value, you know, if we live in a metaverse, you know, maybe we can. You know, It's really, I actually don't have a good answer for it. One of the ones you can, look, in terms of an index, I just said it before, you know, at least referenced it, was the idea that markets sort of grow at 10% compound. It's like, well, yeah. What actually happens though, when you break that down, is you have a handful of companies that grow at extraordinary rates, like companies that didn't exist. Ford didn't exist. It existed. Made squillions of dollars, created huge amounts of value, and accounted for a huge part of the index's gain. And then it waned, and then now it's other. And so as it waxes and wanes, so as new companies come into existence, Apple didn't exist 30 years ago, and then it did, and now it's the biggest company in the world. And in 30 years' time, it'll be probably something else. One gets taken out, another one gets. You kind of have a bit of a shell game going there that allows that rate to sort of grow. But if you take the world, like planet Earth, and you add up the GDP from every single country, GDP is a crude measure, by the way, but let's go with it. I don't think you can expect much more than 2 or 3%. In fact, if you want to inflation adjust, it's hard to get. I mean, a purist would say the only gains you get are the gains you get through productivity enhancements. In other words, I used to catch a fish with my hands. And then I invented a spear, and then I invented a fishing rod, and then I invented a net, and then I invented a trawler. You know, so as an individual, I can now go out in my boat and catch thousands of fish pretty easy. So that's where the growth comes from. It comes from productivity.
Correct.
I can't magic new resources out of the air. I can only become more productive. Matt, it's such a deep question, man. I love it. I love it. I don't have an easy answer, but
yeah.
What do you think?
Oh, you've done a great job. I'm going to strip it back a little bit here, Matt. So first thing I'm going to say is the 8% is company. The economies tend to grow at about that 2 to 3%. And those numbers are not very different per year, but they're massively different over the long term. So the number of years it takes something to double at 8%, what's that, 9-ish years? At 2.5%, doubles every 30-odd years, roughly, right? And those timescales are really, 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 really different over the extended period of time. So it's much harder to imagine an economy growing at 8%. In fact, Buffett about Berkshire has done the same thing. So look, Berkshire can't continue to grow up better than the economy for too long, otherwise it becomes bigger than the American economy itself. The size is its own restraint. So I want to make that point just because when we start talking about the what and the why and the how, they're very, very different. So let me do the company one and come back to the economy one. Part of the company one is Andrew's point about the productivity of the businesses on the markets. The next one is that, and this is why I like shares rather than property, by the way, without reopening that can of worms, is property is the entire property market in Australia by definition. Every single dwelling added together is the property market. When we look at the equity market, it's not every company in Australia put together. It's only the very, 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 very tiny percentage of Australian companies that are listed on the stock exchange. And so they are a subset by definition. And that subset has over time tended to be A, the highest quality businesses, and B, taken share from those other businesses out there. And so you can have a subset grow faster than the system by definition anyway, even before you add in productivity and that sort of stuff. So there's all of those, that kind of goes into it as well in terms of why companies could grow faster than the economy as a subset of that question. Back to the economy. Andrew, you made a great point. Inflation is part of it because we talk about these things often in nominal terms, including inflation, rather than without inflation. And so the reality is when you strip inflation out, you bring that growth number back a little bit. You then bring back productivity back a little bit and you get to a smaller number again. And then, as you said, and the thing I think is most striking of this one is... Well, there's two, actually. I'll try and do them one at a time. I'll do the easy one first. Technology non-physical goods are super important as a part of this. So think about the growth of the businesses, and I'm thinking about revenues here because profit, again, is a different thing. Amazon is growing because it's taken profit away from everybody else, right? Almost everybody else, almost by definition. And so to some degree, Amazon's growth is Circuit City's loss, went broke in the US, or Tandy's loss here, or Dick Smith Electronics loss here, or maybe not directly to Amazon, but you get the idea. There is some creative destruction here, which is just a reallocation. But technology, think about the products that we consume. Think about social media. Think about streaming video content. Think about, Andrew and I are recording this on Zoom, which the Motley Fool pays for. It has no... there is no resource really being used up relative to the amount of revenue it gains, right? It doesn't have to chop down a new tree every time we do a phone call. It doesn't have to mine some more coal. It doesn't have to use up more food in terms of the physical resources of the planet. So the world is becoming much, much, much more digital, and that actually gives you a massive upside for economic growth. The last one is the really messy, mucky one. Andrew, and jump in this way to either help me or to disagree entirely, but money's a weird thing. I'm not going to get you started on Bitcoin, I promise. I'm going to stop you getting started on Bitcoin. Economic growth, and back to the kind of fractional banking system, the idea that, I spend more, so Andrew earns more, so Andrew spends more, so I earn more, so I earn more, so Andrew spends more, that kind of, I make that up, you get the idea. The round-and-round in circles, the multiplier effect of that is kind of, to some degree, a little bit of a shell game. but that impacts both inflation, as we just talked about where I started, and the actual productive output of the economy. So if I produce something someone else wants, they're going to pay me more for it. I'm going to spend more money, which gives them more money, and so on and so forth. It's why the economy is something of a shell game and why it relies on trust so much, because we couldn't liquidate all the assets. A bit like a bank run. You couldn't liquidate all the assets of the financial markets writ large, including property and everything else. So give me the money for that.
There's not enough money in the world. Right? Yeah.
It doesn't exist. And that's okay. Like it's a feature, not a bug, but it does kind of mess with your head a little bit. I see a lot of people say, the economy can't keep growing or degrowth has to be the answer. I think there's some value to that. I really do. And I think we're going to have a reckoning around that, because your underlying assumption about if it can't grow forever is absolutely true by definition. Literally. So, there is an end point. Is it a decade away, a century away, a millennium away, or multi-millennia away? I don't know. No one can know. But my sense is, if you think about in 1800 and something, 92% of us worked on farms. 8% of us did non-farm jobs. These days, how many in the knowledge economy, so-called knowledge economy, how many working in digital realms? My humble bloke plays Minecraft on the computer. We pay Microsoft some money for that every month. That kind of stuff happens, and there's no additional creation, or more importantly, there's no additional resources being used up for that. So the resource intensity, if I can say it, of the economy is falling, and falling pretty fast. And I think that will continue to be the case. And so that
just
actually,
just very very God, quickly, yeah. there is some power and server costs and infrastructure, but yes, so it's not free.
But that's what I'm saying. The resource intensity of that dollar being spent continues to decline.
Yeah,
you know, it's not free. It, you know, if I was to buy him a toy car, it would. And I'm not saying that, by the way, toy cars they probably are better than my being stuck in front of a screen. But if I was to buy him a toy car, it would cost time, money, energy, resources to make it, you know, smelt the metal or cut down the wood or carve the wood or whatever. When he gets to play with virtual digital blocks, it's just going to be less resource intensive per dollar spent than it would be if I bought him a physical toy, which I probably, again, I should do. I'm not saying it makes sense as a developmental thing. We'll have my parenting critique later. But yeah, there's something to that in the meantime. The resource intensity of the incremental dollars we're spending continues to decline reasonably precipitously, particularly over a two-century basis. But yep, we're actually going to have to pay the piper at some point on this one, and there is no perfect single outcome. Did I do an okay job of that?
Yeah, we could catch up for an hour a day for the next 6 weeks and talk about it. We could get the world's greatest economists and thinkers in, and there'd be huge debates. Yeah. And this is the thing that just blows your mind. But I just love, I love the question, because I do often think there is such value in just questioning and coming at things from a first principles kind of standpoint.
Yep.
You know, it's just we're just slightly smarter than average monkeys, and so much of our world is just the shared narrative that we have. You know, it's worth remembering that at times. You know, I mean, I keep wanting to go towards Bitcoin only because it sort of helps explain monetary policy and the rest, but I won't. I'll go instead to another favorite hobby horse, which just quickly, it is why I think you can say, well, why I can say and have egg all over my face is why property, this idea that property grows at 7% every year, it's just sort of like, well, that means it doubles every 10 years. So, I mean, that can go on for a long time, but it fundamentally doesn't, because if I extrapolate that forward, it gets to a point where Australian property is worth more than the entire GDP of planet Earth. I mean, mathematically, right? 10% is exponential growth. It just, you can't, right? Not, okay, we want to talk about indices are different. As you say, things come in, things go out, things get taken from somewhere else and then put into other things.
Yep.
But when you're talking about aggregate level kind of stuff, it physically can't. And also, not only that, but the money that's coming in to do that, it's coming from other, perhaps, you know, potentially more productive places. So it's kind of, it's wild. It's wild. Mm. Anyway, I get myself into trouble if I keep talking. But I think it's an outstanding question and one worth seriously thinking about.
Yep, I like it. The other thing I would say, though, is we need to be a little bit careful not to disappear into its own self. You know, there's some navel-gazing in that, which theoretically is super, super interesting. Investing-wise, I think you might tie yourself in knots unnecessarily doing so. Is that reasonable to say? Without wanting to be dismissive and say, don't worry about it, doesn't matter, just, you know, don't worry your pretty little head about it. There is some element of kind of like, it's interesting, but in the meantime, don't lose the opportunity.
Yeah, I think so. Like 10,000 years ago, someone grabbed a clay tablet and they said, I've got 10 sheep. And I'm going to just give it to you, and I'm going to record it on this.
Yeah.
And we've just been doing it ever since in more and more complicated ways. Like, that's what we've been doing.
Yep.
And it's just really, when you think about it, this whole system of finance that we have, we just use these tokens called dollars just to sort of keep track of everything.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and then
it's a way to equivalize the amount of work we do and the number of things we have.
It allows us to get away from barter.
Yeah.
It allows us to do things really powerful, like specialization. Mm-hmm. It allows us to transport value across time and space.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the world's greatest inventions. Like money, without money, we're still living in communities of 100 or 200 people and fighting each other with spears. Like literally, that's where we are. It is a global coordination mechanism. But when you strip away all the complexity, that it really is like, hey, I'm going to do something and this is creating value for someone, whether because I'm providing them a service or I'm building something for them or making something for them. And someone else sees that as value and they're going to do something else. And then we're just going to coordinate it all through these little, whether it's a seashell or a glass bead or, you know, a US dollar or, dare I say, a Bitcoin. It's whatever you want to use. That's what we're trying to sort of coordinate here. And it's just worth keeping grounded on all of that stuff. It's why I think you can look at a lot of this macro stuff that we're going through, it gets to a point where it's sort of like any great, like look at the GFC, just pick a recent one, when everyone just starts rampantly speculating on collateralized debt obligations. Yeah, exactly. You know, just you get to, people go, oh, I don't understand it, but I assume it makes sense because a lot of smart, rich people are doing it. It's like, no, it actually doesn't make sense. And you're right to question. And if you can't understand it and if you can't explain it simply, it's actually a giant red flag. E.g. NFTs, e.g. all these other kinds of things. It's just like, if it doesn't translate back to some kind of real world value, then there's something that for the trouble is with these things is like craziness can go on for a long, 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 long time before it sort of someone opens the shades. I'll stop at this point.
No, it's a good point. It's also going back without going back over the old grants. It's why the real returns after inflation matter and that kind of stuff to really strip back what is the incremental return being made, because the value of money continues to increase. That inflation bit is never real in any meaningful way, right? Something costs me a dollar now, $1.03 in 6 months' time. It's still only one thing. And so that part of the growth you just need to discount by definition, because there is literally zero incremental resource. It's just that we denominate it differently. And so, you know, it's just, well, that's one of those things.
And to bring it to an investing standpoint, you know, this is why, you know, Buffett talks, you know, price does not equal value.
Yep.
And it's kind of one of those, it feels like a double speak. Like the first time you hear that, you go, what? But it's just like, well, one measures the other.
Yeah.
But that's what you're asking when you invest in a company is like, what value is being created here for shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really great question. Mm-hmm. You know, BHP creates value because it digs up this stuff called iron ore that we actually need to build the modern world. That's value. That's valuable. Again, you can get into the weeds with how you value that and the rest of it. Apple makes these really cool devices that everyone likes, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there are other companies that really don't do much. Lots of them on the ASX, you know, or you're really buying a promise that we will do something valuable in the future. And that's when you get, you know, ask yourself whenever you're buying, whether it's a Rembrandt or a investment property or a share.
Another one.
Jeez. What is the can you ever have too many Rembrandts, Scott?
I don't know yet, mate. I haven't found my limit.
Let me know. But you know what I mean? It's like that is the fundamental question to ask. Yeah. What is the value being created here, and is it being represented fairly? It's very powerful.
Nice. Matthew then goes on, by the way, to say, P.S. You asked for suggestions on episodes. I would love to hear an episode on crypto in general with all the gory details. I'm a trained software engineer and have done serious reading as you have suggested. I am not convinced it offers or will offer italics anything, close italics, of value that doesn't already exist in a superior form. They are slow. Visa does 1,700 transactions per second versus Ethereum at 30. Inflexible. Code can't be changed easily once published. Inefficient, 100%, 100% uses more power than Argentina, makes everything public, get ready to be doxxed and data mined by big companies, and worst of all, completely centralized, in that the big miners suck up market share. This is not to mention the negative social externalities, as specified in the YouTube documentary Line Goes Up. How could you invest in an asset which promises the world but has no path to delivery? Please feel free to prove me wrong with technical stats as deep as you want to go. Which sounds like a challenge. And
we are going to do a special episode, so I will hold back on that.
Please.
But let me just say at the beginning that I actually agree with virtually all of that.
Excellent. We'll bother the episode. Andrew is going to sell his Bitcoin tomorrow morning.
I just have to say one thing and then I'll move on. Is that this is what...
No, you're right.
So imagine if I said to you, Scott, we're at a barbecue and I say, oh man, I bought this biotech company and I lost all my money. Shares and mugs game.
Yep.
You would go... Well, you know, just because that was a really crappy investment doesn't mean that investing in shares is a crappy investment. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what my frustration at the moment is that crypto is this very broad term. Yep. And like, I think all of the criticisms that get leveled at it is pretty bang on.
Yeah.
But there's one perfect thing called Bitcoin, and there's a bunch of what are called shit coins, if I can use that language. No. And there's some nuance to be teased apart. And I can't wait. I can't wait to do it. We're going to spend an hour on it. It's going to be great. God.
Well, a bit more than an hour, I'm tipping. I'm not even sure how we're going to have that conversation, but we are going to have that conversation. So I'm looking forward to having that conversation. Mate, that was a good one. All right. So, Matt, you're going to have your wish. You'll get your wish. Another interesting idea for the podcast, I'll hold this one off, but Simon wants us to have a time machine episode where we hypothetically go through what happened, what might happen next, how we prepare for it, and then look at the actual realities as a way of kind of, because he said, you often say comments like, when this podcast is dug up in 10 years' time, we'll know the answer. Mm-hmm. The problem, of course, is the future is unknown. And by the time the circumstances have played out, the issue of the day has long since moved on. With this in mind, my suggestion is a time machine episode. So we'll have a think about that. So thank you, Simon, for the idea.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Noel says, hi, guys. Thanks for the pod. A great pod, he says. Always insightful. Thank you, mate. I have an asset allocation question. For people who are currently paying off a mortgage, I guess there isn't much of an asset allocation question to answer. They simply use their savings to pay off the mortgage. For those of us who rent, do not have a mortgage to pay, and are not planning on buying a property anytime soon, how should we consider asset allocation? For the past 15 years or so, I've been following a basic 60-40 allocation, 60% shares, 40% in bonds or cash. During the COVID crash, I found this cash buffer really useful in allowing me to stomach the plunge in value in the shares portion of my portfolio. And as a result, I was able to remain calm, not sell, and allocate more cash to shares during the downturn. However, most other times, with so little return on cash, this strategy often seems too conservative, especially when compared with most others my age, mid-40s, who, apart from some rainy day money, are, quotes, fully invested, close quotes, via a mortgage and super. Any thoughts on how we should think through the asset allocation question? General advice only, obviously. Thanks and have a great holiday from Noel. Noel, I was going to say Andrew's not having a holiday, but he gets to spend 3 weeks not talking to me, so he may think that's a holiday and I wouldn't
that's a holiday. Him in the slightest.
Everyone's got to have something out of this one. And if Andrew gets to get away from me for 3 weeks, then he's welcome. But by the way, don't feel too happy for him. He's got to spend extra time with me in the next couple of weeks, pre-recording all the episodes. So he's well and truly earned his holiday.
You got to pay the piper eventually.
Exactly. Then again, I get 3 weeks without Bitcoin, so I think I win. what do you reckon, mate? It's a really good question from Noel.
It's a great question.
It's also interesting. So I'm going to just preface this with a comment and then ask you the question. But what I like about Noel's question is he considers residential property, in my mind, shouldn't be considered an investment in the asset, kind of return on assets. You've talked a lot about this before. I've talked about it. I wouldn't consider an investment asset in the same way because it does do things other than just purely financial returns. But it's also worth, what I liked about it is he's saying fully invested via a mortgage and super, that idea of, you say it regularly, opportunity cost. Those people who are saying, well, I've got no extra money or only a little bit extra money because I'm paying off the mortgage are choosing to allocate some money to that. So they are fully invested in that very different sense. So I kind of just liked that kind of way he framed the question as he asked it. But generally, mate, 60% shares, 40% bonds, cash, benefit during a crash, not great rest of the time necessarily. And Noel's wondering if it's too conservative.
Yeah, I think so. And Noel, the hypothetical you paint is actually my exact situation, mid-40s renting, thinking about how I allocate my capitals. I have thought about it quite a lot. and we did a whole episode on rent versus buy, which I'd encourage you to dig up there because there's a lot of nuance and we went into it in a lot more detail.
Yeah.
But I think, mate, you've got another 20 years until you retire. I mean, bonds sort of offer you this veneer of safety, but I'd say they're the riskiest thing you can hold for the long term because they're just going to get eroded away through inflation, really. Right. So it's an incredibly risky investment. They're incredibly safe investments over short to medium terms. They're very, very risky outside. And by the way, they can be risky in the short term. If I have a 30-year bond that I want to hold for a year, that's a really risky investment because the market value of that bond can change. If I'm buying a bond that's going to mature in a year or two, that's different because it's the IOU. I'm going to get all my money back plus any coupons along the way. Mm-hmm. So, bonds, forget about them. I mean, like you will over the next 20 years suffer through, I don't know, probably two or three really bad bear market. If history is any guide, two or three and maybe more. Right. You're guaranteed to do it. But despite all of that, again, history, I can't, someone's made the comment already. It's a good comment and we need to make it. But the past is no guarantee of the future.
Yep.
But if you find that as a reasonably useful guide to the future, Then yeah, I would be 100% in equity. It feels like this funny money kind of stuff, but just again, back to first principles. You're just taking ownership in a bunch of productive businesses, and you know, I don't think it's as risky as numbers on a screen is what the impression that most people tend to have. So it's going to be far. If you were 58, I'd be saying something entirely different, but you're not. So yeah, I would just go that way. I would leave some cash for the, you know, your car gets wiped out, or you know, the hot water heater blows up. There's always life's little surprises that you have to deal with. So you want to make sure that that's kind of covered there for a little bit. But other than that, 100% shares, man.
I think, for me,
very quickly, let me just...
Yeah, no. I agree. I'm exactly in your camp, mate. The only cash I like to have in my investing is the money I've just saved and almost about to invest. I don't do cash on the sidelines at all. I don't have any income needs from that cash, so I don't have to worry about that. If I did, I would absolutely have money aside, as you say, mate. With one exception, one really, 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 really important exception, which is that... to Noel's point, it depends on the degree to which he needs to have that psychological cushion or buffer. You know, to quote Noel, he says, "As a result, I was able to remain calm, not sell and allocate more cash to shares during the downturn." If being 60-40 in shares and cash and or bonds is the best way for any of our listeners, we can't give you personal advice, Noel, as you well know, for any of our listeners to manage their own psychology, emotions, portfolio during those times. If you end up with a subpar or suboptimal return, I don't mean suboptimal in a critical way. I mean, like, you know, to your point, Ram, I think you get a better return with shares. So if you choose not to have as much money as a higher proportion in shares, I think you're probably choosing for a suboptimal, as in less than completely maximized return. But if having a slightly suboptimal return lets you avoid being even more suboptimal, because you do sell when things get rough, and then buying again if things go back up again, you could be, you know, cutting 20% chunks out of your portfolio every time there's a crash, and that's really going to hurt you more than being probably, maybe not, but I would argue more than being a little bit more conservative with that allocation. So if you're asking us, we say this regularly, if you're asking us mathematically, what do we think the best return is going to be? I'm with Andrew, certainly historically, and I believe in the future, shares will outperform, I think, property. And I think with a high degree of certainty, they'll outperform bonds. So if you're asking me, if I had to invest over the next 20, 30 years, what would I do? I'd say, well, I'd be in shares, because I think that's going to give you the maximum return. So that's what I would do. It's what I am doing. But if you're saying I can't do that and sleep at night or withstand those crashes, then I'm saying to you, right, allocate as much to cash as you need to allow you to withstand those falls, so you're not tempted to do anything. I'll say silly. I don't mean silly in a critical way, but you know, so do anything bad or inadvisable when those sort of circumstances hit. So, I think asset allocation is generally, I'm always stuck with this one. I don't want to criticize the financial industry too much, because there is always that line between behavioral and mathematical outcomes, right? I think asset allocation, if someone pretends to you asset allocation is about maximizing your returns, then you need to call them out on that, because it absolutely does not. Absolutely does not. Year on year, it minimizes the chance of a really, really bad year. Absolutely. It also minimizes the chance of a really, really good year. And I think it minimizes the chance of a maximized total long-term return. So if someone says to you, have a broad asset allocation because it's good for your portfolio, I would say, respectfully, rubbish. If they say, here's what I think is best for you because of your risk tolerance, that's a very, very different question. I think I've said before, you know, the only good advice is the advice that's taken. And so, you know, if an financial advisor said to me, look, Scott, I hear what you're saying. This client needs to be 30% shares, 70% cash, because it's the only way they can invest, and at least they're getting something on that shares portion, I'm like, cool, I get it. If they say it needs to be 60-40 because that's the best, you know, alpha, beta, delta, gamma, long-term volatility, blah, 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 I'm like, I hear you, but you're talking rubbish. You've let the academics take over the reality. The better return is going to come from the best quality asset class. And in my experience, in the experience of the market over long periods of time, that is, and I think will continue to be shares. Fair?
Yeah, I mean, just go back to first principles. Yeah. You know, it's just...
Yeah, totally, exactly.
Look, yep. there's there's the value in cash, gold, bonds, you know, it's kind of like that is generally it's going to be there when you need it to be there. And there's value in that. I'm not the last person to say there's no value in that.
Exactly.
But generally speaking, and if you're like looking towards a large purchase in the nearish term or even the medium term, that's a really great option. I'd definitely consider it.
Yep.
But if your goal is instead long-term wealth creation and planning for a retirement that is a decade or so away, it's just the worst because the compromise there is, yes, you get the safety at the expense of the returns. The market will give you the returns at the expense of the quote-unquote safety. And even then, that's not the best word because it just means volatile. It means it moves around a lot. It's very emotional.
That's right.
Do you know? But again, when I say first principles, I mean they're real-world businesses. You know, I mean, for the most part, you know, there's a whole bunch of people who bring food from farmland, stuck it on the shelves, and there's a really valuable. We talk about value creation. That is the fact that I can wander down the street, go for a 10-minute walk, and have products from all around the world neatly packed up for me. That is immensely valuable to me. And there is a company that is providing that. It employs tens of thousands of people. It'll probably be around for a long time to come. That's a real world thing. You know, there's other ones out there that will look after the toll road that I drive to work on. There's another one out there that makes sure that when I punch some numbers into my phone, I can talk to someone on the other side. You know, these are all real world things. And kind of when you, really, really deep onto this stuff, it's like, well, the person who says that's not going to work out is kind of saying, well, not kind of, is explicitly saying society is going to collapse. Which it might, by the way, it might. Maybe there's a nuclear war tomorrow. I mean, in which case, who cares, right? Like whatever, whatever your investment is, you're stuffed, right? So it's kind of like it's a bet on the ongoing progress and prosperity of humanity. Yep, now, if you don't think that, then go buy a tent and some seeds and a shotgun because that's your best portfolio. But if you do believe in that, and it's probably a good bet, then yeah, productive enterprise, man. It is. Businesses just creates far more value than a block of land or a chunk of metal or you know a pretty picture. Just does.
And particularly individual businesses, right? Back to the question we answered earlier, the overall economy can only grow at a certain size, and short of the mix between profit and labor shifting, which it has by the way over time, obviously capital and labor more accurately. You know, the economy grows at the growth of the economy, which is then split up between capital and labor. If you want those returns, as you say, Ram, not only it's business, but it's to my mind anyway, the best businesses. It's possible the best properties also do better than the property market. So
undoubtedly.
If you do that, that's also worthwhile, right? So, you know, we should be a little bit careful. We don't say the property market versus this company singular, because, you know, it is the whole thing. But the good news is that the best, biggest, fastest growing, best prospect businesses tend to be almost always at large, individual private companies notwithstanding, listed. So you know the stock market self-selects quality for you. So not only if you buy an ET, you get a diversified portfolio of Australian businesses, but you get a diversified portfolio of the best or most of the best Australian businesses. Yeah. And that puts the odds even further in your favour.
Yeah.
Mate, one last question from Genevieve and then we'll finish up for this Sunday. Hi, Scott and Andrew. She says, I'm addicted to the podcast and I love the Good Oil pod too. Thank you, Genevieve. And I really appreciate the thoughtful, common sense approach delivered with authenticity and humility. And she likes me too. My only wish is that the mailbox episodes dropped earlier on a Sunday. I would love to hear your dulcet tones, dear. I'd love to have your dulcet tones accompany me as I exercise and or do the housework in the morning. I'll put this out. If you want our mailbag episodes to drop at an earlier time, let us know. Genevieve has. There's no reason why it needs to be midday, by the way. We just chose a time that we thought was reasonable. We do drop the Friday ones after the market. We used to do it, I think, at 4 or earlier. We changed that for entirely internal purposes, but actually lets us have better conversations with our members, which is that our trading rules apply for 2 trading days either side of any public comments at the Motley Fool. This is not Andrew, this is Motley Fool. And
I front run everything.
Exactly.
Joke. That's a joke, Asik.
It's nice working with you. But yes, because it just means that because it's after market, it just makes that simpler. If it was dropping during market hours, it makes the calculations difficult and just means we can talk about less stuff generally, or at least it raises the risk. So we decided to do that after the market. Sunday lunchtime was just kind of an arbitrary decision. We just thought, you know, you get at some point in your weekend. So if you want it earlier, like Genevieve, let us know. Literally, just hit us up because we don't really care. We pre-record them. It can go at any time. We try and spread it out between that and the Friday episode, so we're going to have two eps drop at the same time. But we're not precious, so whatever you want. Thanks, Genevieve, though. It's very kind of you to say. My question or topic for exploration is around personal relationships and investing. Specifically, how to ensure different risk tolerances or approaches do not end up damaging your relationship. The good news is, Genevieve, that Andrew and my wives would agree that we are very, very good at relationships, and you've come to the right place for relationship advice. Frankly, you know, we're good at finance. We're very, very good at relationships. No, we have very, very patient spouses. Maybe we'll try and lean on that. Two examples, she says. One, investing someone else's money, e.g. looking after a portfolio for a parent, sibling, child, or close friend. Two, investing shared money, for example, with a spouse. She says, here's my war story. My dad has been investing since the 90s and did quite well for a while. In 2007, I let him convince me to take out a margin loan and let him invest a significant in equities on my behalf just prior to the GFC. He has a penchant, I like that word, for speculative gold explorers. And let's just say we have very different investing ideas. Over time, I've gradually wrestled back control over my portfolio, but it has come at a significant cost, both financially and relationship-wise. I'm sorry to hear it, mate. That's not good. In retrospect, I wish I'd been more assertive, but at the time I was trying to prioritize my relationship. Being, quotes, right is very important to my dad, who is particularly prone to various cognitive biases over my finances. Any tips, ideas, principles, etc., welcome. Full on, Genevieve. That's a really, 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 really great question, Genevieve. Firstly, as I said, I'm sorry you had those losses, and I'm sorry it's harmed your relationship. I'm going to give you a little bit of relationship advice, mate. I think you're doing exactly the right thing, and I think that I will hopefully kindly and gently say that I think that your dad's not giving you a particularly good financial outcome. And I think that if there is an element of control going on there, it's probably not particularly healthy in your relationship more broadly. You probably know that. I'm absolutely no psychologist or relationship counselor, so I'm trying to be delicate and gentle and not over egg the pudding or overplay my hand here. But Matt, I think you're right to take that back. I think that trying to maintain a relationship is really, 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 really useful and important. But I would also say if that relationship is being maintained at a financial or emotional cost to you, then there are probably some people who are more informed than me, more capable than me, who would say that it might be worth putting a stake in the sand. And while I don't want to be responsible for your relationship with your old man getting worse, I do think there are times and places. And if you know, being right is more important than your financial outcome to him, then there's probably some other conversations to be had or other steps to be taken. So I'll say that delicately and with zero expertise, right? So at this point, I probably should say, like we should with financial advice, go and see a relationship counselor or someone who knows more about this than I do. But it's a really, really important topic. And I think I just worry that it might be symptomatic of other control issues or concerns that might be worth resolving. So I'll say that again, very, very gently, and then walking it back very quickly because I don't know enough to know for sure. So look, in terms of investing someone else's money, I'll go first round because I'm already talking. First thing I'd say is I have invested other people's money on their behalf, only my parents-in-law and my mum. And in doing so, the approach I have always taken from the start is to make sure the first thing they knew, anyone who asked me for advice who I know personally, is make sure that they knew that I don't know what the future holds, that no one can know for sure, that I have a particular approach to investing, that they absolutely need to be long-term. And then I say, I can't tell you what to do, but if I was in your situation, here's what I would do. Or easier sometimes, here's what I am doing myself. And that basically says, I'm not saying telling you what you should do. I'm simply saying, here's what I think makes sense. Here's what I tell our members. Here's what I do myself, or here's what I do if I was in that situation. But then you need to decide what you want to do and whether that's appropriate for you. And doing that lets me show without telling. And also make sure the decision is theirs at the end rather than, hey, I'll manage the money for you. It's, I'm really happy to help you. Here's what I'd do if I was you, but it's up to you. And it puts the agency in their hands, both in terms of their degree of control over what they do, but also their desire otherwise to blame me if things go badly or things go wrong. Not because I'm trying to avoid blame per se, but because it's important for the relationship and for their finances that they are going with their eyes open and willingly doing what they want to do for themselves. Kids is different. I've said before, I've got a little bit of money invested for my son who, you know, doesn't know I'm doing it, and I probably won't tell him because we'll do it at some point at the end of the day. Here's what you've got at some age. Either here, take over the portfolio, or here's the money at some point in time. So that's how we'll do it with that. With a child is easy. I hope that's somewhat useful. Sharing, investing shared money is a really, really different one. Andrew and I both are more involved or more... have a greater role in investing our individual families' monies, but our wives are both involved in the conversations. I'll let Andrew talk to that. But generally, again, it's one of those, here's what I would do. The most important thing for me, because of the way we invest, is get the ethos right. Get the here's what, here's why, here's how. Because if you can get them to understand the way you're approaching it and buy into that, my wife now says, oh, the market's dropped. Oh, at least we're long-term. We don't have to worry about it. You know, of her own volition. And I hope I'm right, by the way, because if I'm wrong about that, then I've led her up the garden path as well as thousands and thousands of our members. But if I am right, she's come to a position where she accepts and believes and agrees that that's the right way to do it. So she's absolutely 100% on board. Doesn't always love it. We still disagree or discuss the investment ideas and decide what to do. But she's bought into the idea of long-term and the growth of the market, all that kind of stuff. Ryan, that's enough for me. What do you think in this context?
Generally, as a rule, I don't give investment advice to family and friends. the most important things, I heard a guy I quite like called Naval Ravikant. He's a bit of a thinker, a tech entrepreneur. Anyway, I think he nails it. He sort of says the three big things in life are your health, your mission. So, you know, what gets you out of bed? What are you here to sort of do on the planet? You know, whatever that is for you. Bitcoin. So your health, your mission, and relationships. They're the three big ones, right? That's actually a lot of psychology and science to back that up. That's kind of what matters. It's sort of like if you've got some really bad health issues, kind of nothing else matters and et cetera. If you can be the richest person in the world, but if everyone hates you and you've got no friends, you're probably a miserable person.
Yeah.
So they're the big things. And so I just value my relationships a lot more than and I, you know, that being said, there are exceptions. And when I have given advice, it's usually just, you know, spend less than what you earn, regularly tip it into an ETF, go do what makes you happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's just easy advice. Yep. Yep. So I don't really go much further than that. And then there are some close mates I have where I'll be like, hey, I bought this, because I know that they get it and they're into it and they know.
Yeah,
that
right, okay.
For me to do that, though, it has to be that this isn't advice. This is just me talking rubbish and you do what you do, you man. I don't care. And like they'll call me on my BS and they'll do their own thing, and that's we're happy to have that chat, because I get that this is, because the last thing in the world I want is that friendship to be ruined in 3 years. Someone said, oh, you told me to go Bitcoin and it's gone to zero and I hate you and that friendship's gone forever. I don't want that. So it needs to be someone I feel as though understands that they ultimately making their own choice. When it comes to my lovely wife, same kind of thing. We've, you know, she's heard me bang on about this stuff for ages. But every now and again she just sort of says she'll question things like, are you sure? She'll give you that look that penetrates into your soul, because I'll be going, oh, this and this, and then you go, are you sure? And that's a really good pause for thought. But but also, you know, I think we've been together for ages, and we've been through all kinds of ups and downs on the market. And so it's like she's pretty cool. Actually, this week, I said, oh, wow, it's really scary out there. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I said, oh, you know, this and that, and you know, it could be a big recession. And she goes, what? And I'm like, oh, you know, it's just, you know, it's scary. And she goes, You always tell me not to worry. I was like, now that you're saying you're worried that I'm worried, like, oh well, no, I'm not worried, but it's just sort of noteworthy.
Yeah.
Money is one of those things that can absolutely destroy a relationship.
Yeah.
So I think you need to, anyone out there is it's just relationships are too important to risk on money.
I think that's right. I can't help but add that healthy relationships are too important risks for money. So just to Genevieve's point, if there are other issues that are actually symptoms of an unhealthy relationship, last thing I want her to do is to not worry about her investments because she's worried about placating someone who maybe isn't looking after her best interest despite even potentially their best intentions. So, don't wreck a healthy investment, a healthy relationship over money. By the same token, again, I'm not a relationship counselor by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever. I have zero experience, zero qualifications. Don't listen to me. Except that if you're in an unhealthy relationship and it happens to be one of the symptoms of that, or one of the what's the word, when something's shown as a result. Anyway, one of the examples of that is control over money, and or whatever else. Just have a think about whether, you know, don't jeopardize a healthy relationship, but equally don't let an unhealthy relationship that's actually also costing you money be the thing that you preserve at the expense of, frankly, your mental health and emotional well-being, but also your financial well-being as well. So again, please see someone who knows something about this stuff rather than me. But to whatever extent that's relevant for you listening, then hopefully it might give you just some ways to have a think about it. But Genevieve, really, really great question. Thank you for the thought-provoking question. Hope it sorts out and all works out well for you. Mate, that's it for us for this week. We've had a long one, but it's been lots and lots of fun. Lots of other questions coming in, and yes, at some point soon there'll be a Bitcoin episode because I have to do these things. It's in Andrew's contract.
I'm gonna orange pill you, Scott. Have you heard that term?
You see, you explained this to me off air, and at the time I thought you said orange pill. Such was my lack of ability to understand what actually is going on, and you actually even explained it to me, and I still am not entirely sure.
Well, you haven't watched The Matrix, so you're out of touch in more ways than I even imagined. So it's. But I'm gonna orange pill you, P-I-L-L. I'm gonna orange pill you and our listeners, and that's my goal. It's gonna be a challenge, but I'm gonna try my best.
There are some people that listener who I can pay to make sure this episode never makes it to air. We shall see. We shall see. But until then, fool on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.